I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Jim Oshman, and we're going to talk about his book, Energy Medicine and Therapeutics in Human Performance, and I'm also going to pick his brain a little bit about what he knows that's going on out there on the edge in research. How are you, Jim?
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you and find your books and your website before we get started?
Okay, well, my website is energyresearch.us. And I live in Dover, New Hampshire, and I travel all over the world giving lectures and workshops on energy medicine and infinite consciousness and consciousness. Constitute one of my favorite subjects, so I'm glad to have a chance to chat with you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. Okay. I've spent a lot of time reading your book. I've missed about the last two chapters, so if I leave out something important, I want you to add it in, please. But one thing that you talked about in this book was that there were several different kinds of consciousness to begin with. And I think that's a really important thing because so many people, scientists in particular, use that phrase and they're not on the same page by using the same definition and don't know it. So could you tell us what those various kinds of consciousness are?
Well, what interests me the most is the so-called subconscious. And the subconscious has been kind of a mysterious, nebulous term. Psychologists don't agree that there even is such a thing as the subconscious. And I had a bit of a breakthrough because of an interesting thing that happened. I was giving a talk to light therapists. They're called syntonic optometrists, and they use colors for healing. And I asked the question, how is it that a light shining into the eyes can help you with your sore foot? That doesn't make any sense. The eyes aren't connected to the feet. And I thought about that for a long time, and then I realized what happened that really triggered all of this was recalling something from histology from a long time ago. The retina has a band in it. It's called the outer limiting membrane, and it's a little line that you can see in sections of the retina, and it's a place where the light-sensing cells touch, have contacts, have junctions with connective tissue cells called Müller cells. And I got this totally absurd idea. I'm very interested in connective tissue, so I had this idea that maybe those junctions are places where the light signal that enters the eyes splits into two pathways. One pathway goes through the retinal cells to the nerves, through the optic nerve, to the brain, to the visual cortex, so that you can see what is in front of you. And we form the visual image in our visual cortex. Maybe the light also jumps across into the connective tissue and travels all through your body, through the connective tissue. Well, that was a preposterous idea, but, you know, that's what we do in science. We develop preposterous ideas, and then we try to show that they're completely wrong. Or maybe we're lucky and they're right. And then I came across something called second sight. And this was a phenomenon that was discovered in World War I. It was discovered that a soldier who had his visual cortex damaged or wiped out during a battle could still see in a kind of a way. They couldn't see, really, but they could tell where they were, they could avoid obstacles, they could avoid danger, they could run and jump over rocks, and they could behave totally normally, even though they couldn't see. Well, that seemed to be an indication maybe there was something to this story. Maybe your whole body really sees what's in front of you through the connective tissue. Then I discovered a scientist in England at Oxford who had studied very carefully a man who didn't have a visual cortex on his right side. His left visual cortex was perfectly normal, so he could see. And they did experiments, and they erected a barrier so that he could look at, with his eye that didn't work, he could look at images on a computer screen. And, of course, he couldn't see them. And they put this barrier so that he couldn't look with his good eye and kind of cheat, look around to see what was on the computer screen. So they asked him what he saw, and they put up images on the computer screen. He couldn't see them, but he could tell what they were. And he got all of them right. In 100 tests, he got 100 tests right. Really? They asked him, how do you do that? He said, I don't know, I guess. Well, that's pretty interesting. So that gave me the idea that maybe there was something to this. Maybe sensory systems in general, maybe this is a general phenomenon, that sensory systems have two different pathways to them. One goes to the brain and is the neurological pathway that neuroscientists have studied for years and know a great deal about. And there's another pathway that is through the connective tissue. So I thought about that for a while. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. And then I realized that what happens with sensation, what happens with perception, is a stimulus has to be strong enough to trigger an action potential that is carried by the sensory nerve to the brain for you to sense something. If the signal is too weak, it doesn't trigger an action potential. And the technical term for this is that the sensory system digitizes. It converts an analog signal, which is infinitely variable in intensity, it converts it to an all-or-none action potential that goes to the brain. This is standard neuroscience, and no neuroscientist would disagree with that. In a way, sensory endings are analog to digital converters. And this process of converting from analog to digital means that a very strong stimulus usually gives the same action potential as a weaker stimulus. It keeps the brain from getting overloaded with information. The sensory endings are like kind of filters. And suppose the connective tissue part is not A to D, it's analog, that is, it takes in everything from very weak signals to very large signals. Everything that you see in front of you, everything that you sense in the world around you. And the more I thought about this, I realized that this might be what we have been calling the subconscious. This is not the connective tissue memory, the connective tissue sensation, information processing, is not conscious, it's subconscious. Well, that was an interesting idea also. So that's what I've been... the reason I'm so interested in this is because I'm very interested in energy therapists, I'm very interested in complementary and alternative medicine, and I'm very interested in the ability of a therapist, an experienced therapist, to sense what is going on in the person in front of them. And the place where this is very interesting and very important, I've given a lot of workshops on trauma in Switzerland. The Swiss are very interested in trauma resolution. They're still traumatized by things that happened a long time ago. And so trauma therapy is very popular in Switzerland, and I talk to these therapists about this, and they're very interested because the trauma may be invisible. The scar or the injury or the emotional trauma may be hard to find, and how do you find it? And that's where intuition comes in. So I put this all together to describe what intuition is and what the subconscious is and how to use that and how to access that information. And I basically, when I begin my workshops these days, I tell the people, you know everything and you can do anything. And now please listen to what I have to say that explains why I say that. And the way you know everything is that when the patient comes into your office or even when you hear them on the phone, a vast amount of information comes into your system, far more than you could ever analyze intellectually with your neurological consciousness. And yet it goes into your subconscious, and occasionally you get little glimmers of the truth. They're called flashes of insight. In our culture, we are taught generally to ignore that as kind of a noise. It doesn't mean anything. And what I'm teaching people is to listen. Listen carefully to those little flashes. And I tell them, when you have a patient in front of you, listen to the whispers. Listen to the little voices that say funny things like, it's in his left knee, or something like that. Or it happened at age 3. Well, those little flashes of insight, if you pay attention to them, you find that often they are correct. And they're very valuable in helping you find where you need to go with a patient. And so this is what fascinates me. I've gone to a number of trauma workshops where I'm the only person who doesn't talk about the nervous system. So I make a distinction between neurological consciousness and what you could call connective tissue consciousness, which is different, but is there and is very valuable and useful if you can learn how to use it. And I think that this is how some very, very good therapists are able to do the brilliant work that they can do, which is amazing when you watch them work. How do they know? And the way they know is they pay attention to their subconscious. So there's two kinds of consciousness for you to think about, Eva.
That's so interesting, Jim.
I have a lot of fun with this.
Are you doing any research with it right now? Or are you just lecturing on it?
Well, the research I do is workshops, where I get people to stand back to back, people who've never met each other, and I have them do a scan. Scan through the person behind you, scan from the top of their head down to the bottom of their feet. Just in your imagination, just scan through their body and see what you see. You're not looking at them. You can do it with your eyes closed. It only takes a minute. And listen to the whispers. Listen to what comes when you go through their body. And then they turn around and talk to each other. Well, it's amazing. They often find out something that's going on with the person that they have forgotten about, like an injury to an arm. Well, there's nothing wrong with my arm. Oh, well, I did fall out of a tree 30 years ago. these traumas are speaking. They have a voice, and those traumas can be heard. And I learn as I do this that some therapists do this all the time. This is not a new thing to them. It's totally what they do every day in their work. For others, it's a breakthrough. It's enlightenment. So research, I'm not a researcher in the sense of doing research. I write about research. I think about it. I'm kind of an integrator of discoveries. I've found out that if you can imagine an experiment, there's somebody somewhere who has either done it or is doing it. And I don't need to do research. What we're missing, what we're lacking in our academic structure are people who synthesize information. This is why I like complementary and alternative therapists. They're always looking. They're always synthesizing. They're always trying to figure out what's going on. What can I learn from science that will make this work that I do clearer to me and to my patients? So this is my work. My work is different from, I'm not an experimentalist. I've done experiments, and every now and then I do find something that is so interesting and so important, and I look and I find that nobody has done any experiments on it, then I'll do an experiment. But for the most part, I feel that what I'm doing is having a big conversation, a huge conversation. It's a conversation with you and the people who are listening, the people who go to the seminars and the workshops and the lectures and the symposia where I talk. And sometimes, often, a question from a person in the audience will open up a whole new way of looking at things, a whole new clarity of understanding something. So that's my research. I'm looking for the way things that I know and read about in books and scientific articles and so on, how they fit together. I'm the fitting together guy. That's what I do.
Let me ask you this. What is the significance in glial cells in regarding communication and regulatory roles?
In cells?
Yes.
Well, the big discovery that's really very exciting is epigenetics. And it's the recognition that the DNA is not what it's cracked up to be. We are taught that the DNA is the blueprint of life. It isn't. In fact, a lot of my work has to do with finding things that I've learned that are completely wrong, and helping people get past the inaccuracies of the things they've learned. And epigenetics is fascinating, and it's a very hot topic these days. It's the topic of Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief, The Genie in Your Genes by Dawson Church. David Feinstein has a good book on the promise of energy psychology. It's the basis for, or probably the basis for, these extremely interesting and very effective techniques of energy psychology that are really helping a lot of people get over their emotional issues. And just to give you an idea, Dawson Church, in fact, I've been lecturing with Dawson Church at symposia. We had a symposium in California a couple of weeks ago, part of the Anti-Aging Conference, the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. And what Dawson is doing, recognizing that the genes do not control things. They are under control. The genes are affected by the environment. And Bruce Lipton wrote a beautiful book about that. And Dawson's book is also very, in fact, Dawson got an award for the best healing text of the year a couple of years ago. What Dawson is doing that demonstrates the effects on the genes is he is treating the soldiers who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan who have post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is beautiful work because these guys are sometimes really messed up. They have seen horrific things. And Dawson now, he showed me a film of one of the guys he worked with. The guy was, his leg was jumping up and down, his face was contorted. He's just reliving continually horrible things that he went through. And with a very simple technique of tapping on certain parts of the body, while the person is thinking about these traumatic events, it all calms down. It straightens out. And these people are able to get past their post-traumatic stress. And it's incredible work. It's incredibly important. You know, regardless of your political viewpoint about these wars, we certainly owe the soldiers the best treatment we can provide. And Dawson wants to show everybody, look at this. This really works. This really helps these guys. It helps them get their lives back. It helps de-traumatize them. And what Dawson does in his dedication, he does bake sales to raise money. This is not a well-funded effort. He does bake sales. He raises money. He hires therapists. He treats people. He keeps records of what happens. And he's published a series of papers in scientific journals showing that statistically these techniques work, they're very effective, they produce permanent change, and it's amazing because it's not talk therapy. You don't have to talk about what happened. It's just a matter of tapping on acupuncture points. And why this is so interesting for you, Eva, is because this shows, I think, in fact, all of the alternative therapies are teaching us something. They're teaching us something new about the human body and the human mind. We just don't always know what they are teaching us. And this method of energy psychology, and there are a bunch of variants of this technique. There's the Callahan technique and EFT, thought field therapy, and on there are dozens of techniques. And they all seem to be working very well. What I think they're teaching us is something about consciousness and how the conscious moment is formed and the role of the acupuncture meridians in consciousness, because it's the acupuncture points that are tapped. The therapist or the therapist gets the patient to gently tap on their forehead and on points under their lower lip and above and under their nose and so on. A sequence of points on their hand. And just this simple tapping seems to resolve these chronic emotional traumas.
I have a question.
And what's going on there? Well, what is happening? Well, we had a very interesting thing happen. Can I tell you a story?
Absolutely.
Okay, here's what happened. I gave a talk at this conference in San Jose, anti-aging conference. I gave a talk about pulsing electromagnetic field therapy. And pulsing electromagnetic field therapy is very interesting. It's used to jumpstart the healing process. It's using magnetism, pulsing magnetic fields. And these fields have to be very weak. They have to be certain frequencies and so on. So I talked about that. And then Dawson showed his work on the energy psychology and these tapping techniques. And a woman in the audience said, Jim, when you tap on those acupuncture points, you're doing pulsing electromagnetic field therapy. Oh, my goodness. Now, I don't know who she was. I wish I did. But that really put a lot of things together, because when you tap on an acupuncture point, or when you tap on any place, or when you touch any place on the body, you produce electricity. It's called the piezoelectric effect, or pressure electricity. It's been known for 100 years. It happens because of the crystallinity of the connective tissue. It generates electrical fields. Well, when you tap on an acupuncture point, you're generating pulsing electric fields. And that's very similar to pulsing electromagnetic field therapy. So what you're doing is you're putting pulsing fields into this system, and the meridians are electrically conductive. They also conduct light. So you're putting pulsing fields into the meridian system while the person is thinking about their traumatic experience. And somehow, this alters consciousness. I think this is one possible explanation. There are other possible explanations, but I love having a possible explanation to explore. So that woman's question really lit my lights. It really was very, very sensible what she said. It really made me realize, right, there's a similarity. And the other aspect of this that is so interesting is that the therapists who are doing this work, who are doing energy psychology, are finding that not only do people's traumatic emotional states subside, but their physical ailments go away as well. And this is if there's one really outstanding discovery of the recent times in complementary and alternative medicine, it's that many diseases just evaporate when you find the source of the emotional trauma. They just go away. And many techniques are showing this, and it just is showing the relationship between mental state, consciousness, and physical disease.
Can I ask you a question here?
Oh, sure.
When you're doing the tapping, I interviewed Dan Benor last week and we were talking about this. So when you're doing the tapping, does it matter what you're thinking? Do you have to be thinking about that? And does it matter how many times you tap? Do you tap in a sequence, or do you just tap, tap, tap? Or does it matter how you do it and what you're thinking when it happens?
You know, one of the interesting things about it is it's a self-regulated phenomenon. That is, the patient regulates the frequency of tapping. And in a sense, they may be tuning it to themselves. I mean, some patients tap fast, some tap slow, and they're tuning the therapy to their own system. The methods... it's just a sequence of points on the body that you tap. The therapist asks you to think about what is bothering you and give an indication of the level of discomfort on a scale of 1 to 10. And for some of these people, they are really very upset. I mean, they're up at 9 or 10. They are really in trouble. And then they take a few minutes and... there are some affirmations that are spoken. They ask the patient to speak an affirmation that having to do with letting go of the experience. I don't do this work myself, but there are lots of increasing numbers of people who are doing this because it's just so wonderful. And the patient does the tapping, and then the therapist asks where they are on the scale of 1 to 10 in terms of their anxiety or discomfort. And it goes down. Their discomfort goes down, and it stays down. And Dawson has done follow-up studies. 6 months later, these people, not only does he work with the veterans returning from the war, but he works with their families because they're often traumatized as well. And so this is beautiful work. I mean, this is just relieving a very dreadful state of affairs for many people. And we need to have more people doing this work. It's so simple, it's easy to learn, and it's so effective.
Let me ask you another question. What is, you talk in your book about the relationship between the emotional state and skin elasticity. Is that tied in with this tapping too, or is that something different? And you also talked about polarization of the skin battery. What is that? I've never heard that before.
Well, the skin, the battery does have a skin. The skin does have a battery. It does have a voltage across it. And one of the ideas is that when the skin is broken, when you have an injury, it sets up a wave called the injury potential. Robert Becker did a lot of work on this. In fact, Robert Becker, he is part of the inspiration for the work I told you about earlier. He recognized that the connective tissue is involved in signaling when there's been an injury. And the injury potential is created because there's a battery across the skin. When the skin is broken, there's sort of a little spark that propagates over the surface of the body and throughout the body. In fact, all tissues in the body can set up injury potentials. If you have a heart attack, the heart muscle has an injury potential that propagates through it. So it's a characteristic part of the healing response. And what it does, I believe, is it draws cells to the site of injury. And this is important. When a tissue is injured, cells have to migrate to the place of injury and clean up the debris. The immune system reacts, cleans up the debris, fights off pathogens if bacteria has gotten into the body, and lays down new tissue. So these potentials, these electrical fields, are involved in the repair process. And if they don't happen, and that's what's interesting about this, we're interested in when healing doesn't happen. What goes wrong? Why does an injury not heal? This is what a lot of medicine is about. This is what brings a lot of patients to the doctor, is their body isn't healing something that the body knows how to heal. And the question is, what's going on? Why is that healing response that the body knows not taking place? And one of the possibilities is that the injury potential is not propagating through the tissue very well. So this is why you need to get a massage once a week. Keep your tissue in good shape so that if something happens, your body can respond the way it knows how to do. So this is the value of, this is the value of regular alternative treatments like massage or Rolfing, energy therapies and so on. Even if you feel fine, I go to my acupuncturist when I feel good because I want to continue to feel good. And the acupuncturist tunes me up and keeps my circuits functioning optimally.
Another question that I wanted to know about was, you talk about two kinds of time and when time slows down. Can you talk about that a little bit and peak experiences?
Well, most people have had the experience of time slowing down.
What happens when they do that?
It happens often when you have an accident, people having automobile accidents often describe how it's like time stopped and things seem to be moving in slow motion. And what's going on there, I think, is that the clock that regulates consciousness has speeded up, and it gives you faster pictures of the world and gives you time to respond. And it's a characteristic of traumatic events, whether they're physical or emotional traumas. And there's a wonderful book that describes the meaning of all of this for psychology. It's called Trauma Energetics by Bill Redpath. And Bill Redpath wrote a fascinating story of his own experience of his tortured life. He really had a hard time. He was he just wasn't functioning emotionally in the world. He had a lot of emotional difficulties. His life was a continuing tragedy to the point that he went to England and studied tragic theater so he could go on the stage and live out his tragic nature. And he was getting a therapy session in which, and this was Peter Levine who was doing this work, and Peter Levine has done some really profound work on trauma. And all of a sudden, Bill went back to when he was just a young boy running through the field in his bare feet and stepped on a piece of glass, and it cut his foot, and that was the beginning of his life of tragedy. It all traced back to that, and his father screaming at him to not cry as the doctor sewed up the tear in his foot, and that was the beginning. And for many people, it is some traumatic thing that happened early in their life that has just messed them up. So Trauma Energetics is the story of Bill Redpath's coming to understand trauma and resolving trauma. And one of the fascinating things he said is that trauma basically is not neurological. And lots of trauma resolution is based on neurology and talking and having people relive experiences and so on. And Redpath said that the trauma is actually set in to the body before the event happens. It's like the fraction of a second before you go flying through your windshield, the body goes, oh my God, this awful thing is about to happen. And that is where it is, it, whatever it is. And so my exploration is finding it. What is it? And it's really, it turns out the traumatic memory is in the tissue. It's not in the brain. You can look in the brain forever and you won't find it. It's in the tissue that's been traumatized. Tissue has memory. All parts of the body can recall the things that happened to them that were disturbing. So Trauma Energetics, the whole story of finding and releasing the lesion that is created actually the moment before the traumatic event happens. And that's where this time slows down comes in.
It seems like it connects in with that seeing, that second sight you were talking about too.
Well, it does. It's as though your body knows ahead of time what's going to happen. And in fact, there's evidence for that. Really remarkable research from the people at the Institute for Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, have done an amazing experiment that shows that the mind is actually scanning the future, a few seconds into the future. And they demonstrated this very clearly. I mean, it's hard, remarkable as that sounds, it's really hard to find a flaw in their experiment.
What did they do?
What they did was they had people, they recorded from the heart and the brain, the electrocardiogram and the electroencephalogram. And they had people look at a computer screen. And the subject would press a button when they were ready, and the recordings would begin of the physiological measurements. And about 10 seconds later, a picture would be projected on the computer screen. It would be a peaceful scene or a violent scene, an emotionally disturbing scene. And what they discovered, and they did careful statistics on this, they discovered that the physiology began to change 4 seconds before the emotional scene was projected. Nobody knew whether the scene would be a peaceful scene or an emotional scene. The experimenter didn't know. Nobody knew. It was selected randomly by the computer. So nobody knew what was coming, but the body responded. And it turned out that the heart responded first, before the brain. The heart knew what was coming, picked that up before the brain. So the heart is a sensor. And it turns out that the heart has 10,000 neurons in it, and there's a lot of work on neurocardiology. There are books on neurocardiology, the relationship between the heart and the brain. The heart is very intelligent and is very clever and seems to pick up on emotional things before they happen. The evidence is clear. This was reported in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine a couple of years ago. And the conclusion, the heart is constantly scanning the future. And one of the little pieces of the study was that women were better at this than men, which is no surprise.
Interesting. Let's see, there's something else. Oh, I'd also like to ask you about physiological importance of symbols. I don't really get how the information stores in the symbols.
Well, you know, I gave a detailed lecture about this in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, earlier this year. I talked to about 1,100 Reiki therapists. There's a lot of Reiki therapists in Argentina. And one aspect of Reiki is the use of symbols. And when you do the Reiki therapy, this is just one part of it, is you can draw a symbol, or you can look at a symbol, or you can visualize it with your eyes closed in your mind's eye. You can imagine it in front of you. And these symbols seem to be very powerful, and they have been handed down through generations of therapists and seem to be very effective in affecting the body. And that, of course, is preposterous. That doesn't make any sense at all, that looking at a symbol could have any effect on you or a person that you're treating. So I thought about that for a while, and I realized there's a very simple explanation of how that works. And the explanation is that when you look at a symbol, when you look at anything, there's a pattern of light on your retina. And that pattern of light is conducted through your optic nerves to your visual cortex, and it's amplified. The neuroscientists have shown that the signal increases in intensity as it goes from your retina to your visual cortex. Part of it is because for every cell in your retina, there are 100 cells in your visual cortex. So there's a lot of electrical activity that corresponds. It's actually kind of like a fingerprint of what you're looking at. And the symbol will give a particular set of frequencies and spatial relationships between different kinds of signals. And this will also appear as a biomagnetic field in the space around your head. And these fields have been measured. They're measured with magnetoencephalograms. These are multi-million dollar, very sophisticated devices that measure the magnetic brain waves. And the thing to realize about it is that one of the mistakes is thinking in terms of brain waves. The brain waves are not confined to the brain. They spread all through the body. So, for example, what has happened around here in New Hampshire is that Reiki has become very popular as a preoperative treatment. You know, all of the hospitals here in New England offer Reiki preoperatively. The surgeons give all of their patients a little folder that says, "Sail through your surgery."
Really?
And the idea is that there is a Reiki symbol that activates the immune system.
Does insurance cover it?
What's that?
Does insurance cover that kind of stuff up there?
I don't think so. I think, in fact, a lot of it is offered for free. The therapists volunteer to do this. They love this work. And the surgeons are happy because the patients seem to sail through their surgery. They spend less time in the recovery room. They're relaxed when they go into surgery. It seems to work all the way around. And one of the ideas is that those frequencies that are set up by looking at a symbol or drawing a symbol or even visualizing a symbol with your eyes closed, that represents a set of frequencies that are able to have an effect, and they actually, your whole body is radiating those frequencies when you've cleared your mind and all you're focusing on is that symbol. Out of your hands and really out of your whole body comes that frequency or set of frequencies which seem to have a beneficial calming effect and activate the immune system so you're ready for your surgery.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes or 4 minutes. I'll let you talk about anything you want to talk about in this remaining time.
Okay.
Maybe.
Well, I'm doing some writing now about the discoveries in physics and entanglement, and this has to do with consciousness, your favorite subject. Quantum entanglement, the fact that we're all connected together, and this really comes from quantum physics. This is the great discovery of quantum physics. This is what distinguishes quantum physics from all the physics that went before. And I found this wonderful book, and I highly recommend it. It's called The Age of Entanglement. Have you heard of this, Eva?
No, and I'm writing it down.
Louisa Gilder, G-I-L-D-E-R. What she did, and this is so readable, this teaches you physics from conversations between the great physicists of the last century. And she put these conversations together from their books and their collected papers and their articles and all of their notes and so on. And they're fascinating, fascinating stories of people getting together. One of them here is, this was when Summerfield and Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein got on the trolley in Copenhagen and started to talk, and they got so excited they went past their stop and kept on going, and then they had to get off and take the train back the other way, the trolley back the other way. And the quote is, "We rode back and forth in the streetcar because Einstein was really interested at the time. We don't know whether his interest was skeptical or what, but we went back and forth many times and we don't know what people thought of us. Anyway, this is about these conversations, and out of it came the basic realization that, and this is the summary, whenever two things interact, they entangle. And we're entangling, all of us right now, we're interacting. You and I and all the people who are listening are interacting. It doesn't matter if they're photons, atoms, or bigger things, like dust mites, microscopes, cats, or people. The motions of subatomic particles are dominated by entanglement. When they interact, they lose their separate existence. No matter how far they move apart, if one is tweaked, measured, observed, the other seems to instantly respond. The whole world lies between them.
How do you know which two are connected, Jim? I've always wondered that.
Well,
you can't grasp that.
The fascination for me is that I find that lots of therapists now are doing distant healing. I know Reiki therapists, body talk therapists, polarity therapists. That's all they do. They don't treat people who are in their presence. They do all of their work over the phone. And that's absurd. That doesn't make any sense until you look at the physics and the quantum physics of the way the world works. And this is a consequence of quantum physics. We are entangled, and we can change things that are going on with people at a great distance. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I just don't understand how they know. How do they know which two particles are connected? And how do they prove that? I believe it, and I know it's true. I just don't understand it.
Well, there's a lot of technical stuff that goes with it. This book by Louisa Gilder will explain it to you in a very clear, simple way that you will be able to understand. These experiments are done in physics laboratories on the one hand, and they're done in the healing, in the world, of, in the context of healing, and I think it's the same thing.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Jim. We're out of time. Thanks so much. Thanks for everything you do, and thanks for listening.
Okay.
It's important.
Thank you.
And not enough of us do it.
I hope you're having fun, Jim.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Hare.